It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Writing as a way of healing and making sense of military service this hour. A little later, I'll talk with Randy Brown. He is a veteran and poet. He's also a journalist. He blogs under the name Charlie Sherpa. My first guest today is Dennis Malsby of Ames. He's a retired bank president, an award-winning poet and short story writer, and a veteran of the Vietnam War. In the past year, he's published a poetry collection, Near Death, Near Life, and a collection of short stories called Free Fire Zone, and he is here with me now. Hello, Dennis.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
It's a pleasure.
I want to start off by going way back in time to 1964 when you joined the service. Tell me what was going on in your life at that time.
Well, I was within about 6 weeks of graduating from Grinnell College here in Iowa, and I got a letter from the draft board in my hometown of Marshalltown, and they said, what are you going to be doing now? Are you going on to get an advanced degree? Are you getting married? You know, what's your situation? And having $1.92 in my pocket, I certainly wasn't going on to get an advanced degree. I talked to the draft board, and they said, hey, you better go make a deal with a recruiter because you're a perfect specimen for the draft, and nobody's going to hire you because you'll be taken away from them.
They'll assume that you're going to be drafted right away, right?
Yes. So I did talk to the recruiter and went into the service voluntarily, thinking perhaps that would be a career path. They sent me to Fort Leonard Wood for my basic training, and then I received an entry into military intelligence. So I spent about the next 18 months in Monterey, California, learning Russian. Once they finished with Russian, we went to Washington, D.C., where I was involved in a special research project. And that we used modified court stenography boxes to take down Russian voice transmissions. And that was theoretically supposed to connect directly to one of these big old IBM 360s where they would actually print out a transcript of the Russian voice that we intercepted. That project, it didn't work too well because computers of the day were not set up to handle that kind of thing very well. And it was way before the microcomputer. So I volunteered for OCS, went to Fort Benning, became an officer, and shortly thereafter went to Vietnam.
When you were sent to Vietnam, what was your role supposed to be?
We were part of a unit that specialized in electronic intelligence. So we did radio voice intercept. We had Vietnamese speakers that would listen in to Vietnamese transmissions and pull out whatever intelligence we could. We had radio direction finders, so we could try to locate units based on their radio broadcasts. And we had people that were in airplanes, people on the ground, all kinds of ways to intercept their electronic transmissions and derive whatever intelligence we could from them.
Working in intelligence, I think everyone in Vietnam at that time was at risk to some degree or another. How at risk did you feel?
Well, enemy never let us rest. There were, wherever you were in a base camp, whether you were in downtown in a big city, there was always terrorist activities going on, some of which were very similar to what's reported in the news media now. There were roadside bombs. There were assassins. One of the ones that seemed to be most effective when I was there was a young man driving a motorcycle. And motorcycle was one of the scooters, and motorcycles were one of the ways of transportation that were real popular. So you had a street full of these, and on the back would ride your girlfriend. And this particular girlfriend had a pistol underneath her dress. They would drive up next to some GIs, either in a cafe, sidewalk cafe, or walking, and they would shoot one or two of them and then disappear into the crowd. So there was no particular place that you felt safe.
In one of your short stories, you describe an event where a grenade was placed in a gas tank of a Jeep, and the idea was that it was rubber banded to hold the grenade closed, and then the gasoline would erode the rubber band. Eventually, the Jeep would explode. So, I mean, was that something that you actually witnessed happening?
I didn't witness it, but we had many reports come in of that happening. Part of it was due to the design of the gas tank on Jeeps and trucks. The nozzle where you put in the fuel was oversized, so that if you had to refuel out in the in combat situation, you didn't have to worry about getting a funnel. You could just pour the gasoline or diesel directly into the tank. Well, it was just about the right size to hold a hand grenade. But it was shortly after that that the word came down that we were to weld clips on the gas tank, not a cap, that could take a padlock. So you actually lock the gas tank so nobody could open it up and stick a hand grenade in.
Wow. How long were you in Vietnam?
I was there for a year, which is the standard service for U.S. Army and military people.
And again, I mean, the entire time was pretty intense, but you were there during an incredible intense time.
Right.
You were close to Saigon during the Tet Offensive. Can you tell me what you experienced?
My first 6 months in Vietnam, I actually spent in a little village with about half a dozen other Army people. Almost all were intelligence people of various kinds. So we lived right in among the Vietnamese and were able to watch their daily life and be part of it. The last 6 months, I was at Bien Hoa, which is just across the Saigon River from Saigon. And that was where the Tet Offensive, I was there when the Tet Offensive started.
And for people who don't know their Vietnam War history, this was one of the largest military campaigns of the Vietnam War, and it was launched by the forces of the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese Army of Vietnam, and it was a major force.
Right. The North Vietnamese and the South Vietnamese had agreed that they would have an armistice during Tet, which was the Chinese New Year's, and so a lot of the Vietnamese soldiers had been allowed to go home on leave. Well, the North Vietnamese had no intent of honoring that agreement, and they had been moving troops down from out of North Vietnam, out of Laos, out of Cambodia. We had a huge map of Vietnam and the surrounding countries. It was about two stories tall in the building where we analyzed and processed intelligence, and we had little markers up there for each of the units we'd identified, and we could just see them coming down. Our radio direction finding systems kept showing them changing position. They kept moving down out of these other areas and were surrounding the towns. We gave about 2 to 3 weeks' notice to the higher authorities, and they didn't believe us. It was one of those situations that we've occasionally had in the past with our military where you get intelligence and it's no good because it's not acted on.
Well, and I think most history tells us that the Tet Offensive was a surprise, but it was not a surprise to you.
No, in fact, about a week before we were pretty sure they were going to start attacking, I had a precaution, we call it precautionary burning, where we took out all of the paper, a lot of the paperwork that we had accumulated and started burning it, so in case we were overrun, the enemy would not capture that material. And of course, we took precautions around our own part of the camp. So, and of course, here it comes. You know, that was a not a military victory for the North Vietnamese. They did not win that battle, but it was a great propaganda victory.
You went to Saigon the day after the Tet Offensive started?
Yes. We had just had a bunch of new people come in, and we were short of weapons. So I took a jeep full of guys down at the second day of the Tet Offensive, and we went down through on the highway, came to the bridges over the Saigon River. there was two bridges, and one of them had had a whole lane blown off of it. And evidently, Viet Cong frogmen had come up underneath and chanced charges to it. They were, of course, trying to isolate Saigon from any chance of reinforcement. One of the other bridge, had withstood the blast, and we went over into the city. And of course, it looked like those pictures that you see, those films of World War II with bombed out cities. There were lots of collapsed buildings with big holes in their sides of their walls where shells had gone through. There were piles of empty cartridge cases laying here and there where people had fought. The city was divided into a lot of little areas with roadblocks. We got the equipment that we needed and left, and had to stay overnight in Saigon. You didn't travel at night in those kind of conditions. And when we they asked us where we were coming from at the headquarters, and we said, well, we just came from the resupply depot so-and-so, and they took us out onto the front porch and said, see that column of smoke? They just got hit by an enemy attack.
Wow.
So evidently we drove right out through the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese just getting ready to attack that supply base. So,
when did you come home?
Let's see. It would have been probably 1968.
And did you leave the military right away?
I had 6 months left in my service in a way that was good because those 6 months, first 6 months back are always the most crucial time for a veteran returning. And the big problem when you return is that the walls that you built up to contain the fright and the terror that you had experienced and all of a sudden let go. And all of the stuff comes washing out. And to be still under military discipline was a little bit of a help there.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Dennis Malsby. He is a Vietnam War veteran. He's also a retired bank president who lives in Ames. He is an award-winning poet and short story writer. His poetry collection is called Near Death, Near Life. His collection, most recently of short stories, is called The Free Fire Zone. And we will continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about writing as a way of healing and making sense of military service. In a few minutes, I'll talk with Randy Brown. He is a veteran and a poet. He's also a journalist and a blogger who blogs under the name Charlie Sherpa. My guest right now is Dennis Malsby of Ames. He is an award-winning poet and short story writer. He is a veteran of the Vietnam War, a retired bank president as well. In the past year, he's published a collection of poetry, Near Death, Near Life, and a collection of short stories called Free Fire Zone. And Dennis, I want to talk about when you returned home and when you eventually turned to writing. But I think maybe the best way to start this part of the conversation would be with one of your poems. Would you read one for us?
Yes, indeed. This poem is, I've tried to bring the experience of combat to people that maybe don't know combat. And in this particular poem, I do it with by using musical terms, which may be more understandable to a wider variety of people. Yes, because fighting in combat does have its own kind of crazy, mad music. This is called Killzone Requiem. We wade through jungle shadows. Sweat drips off our tiger-striped fatigues to wet red Asian soil. Boots scuff, release fermented biting odors. Butterflies blink wing eyes, shimmy dragon tails. Insects in droning click-bodied clouds flutter, nip, creep. Sawtoothed leaves and vine thorns scarify our necks and arms. The clack of hornbills, the chortle of long-tailed macaques set the tempo. The bass drum whomp of mortars firing slaps our cheeks. Explosions shake triple canopy trees, their creaking limbs a pizzicato of violin and cello. Bodies crazy dance to the brass cymbal screech of slicing shrapnel. We hear the tremolo drumstick smack of jacketed bullets pierce canvas, cloth, flesh. The splintered oboe thunk grunt of metal embedding in wood creates jittering chords. Smoke-curdled air quivers with the clarinet warble of blunt-nosed ricochets. We dying give up a final fugue of voices. Jumbled echoes fade. Weep off elephant grass, strangling fig, twisted lianas.
Killzone Requiem from the poetry collection Near Death, Near Life. When did you first start writing, Dennis?
Well, I tried a lot of other things first, picking the creative mode. I did paintings. I did...
Well, and when you say picking the creative mode, I mentioned this earlier, that you said that when soldiers returned from Vietnam, they had to choose some way to deal with what that they had been through. And there are some destructive ways to deal with that, and you chose creativity as a constructive way.
Yes. And tried a number of creative things, and I would certainly suggest that to anyone that's had a traumatic experience, whether it's civilian or military, that creativity is a good way of dealing with that trauma. I tried painting, sculpture, furniture design, hooking rugs, but those all had a certain short lifetime. And I came upon writing, and of course we have over 1 million words in English. It's certainly enough to last, you know, anyone a lifetime of writing. And writing has been, I started 18 years ago to write and learn about writing, and it has been a great source of therapy for me. After about 5 years of writing about military subjects and my experience in Vietnam, I was able to start writing about other things, hence the poetry book called Near Death, Near Life. Near Death, the military poems, Near Life, you know, the non-military type poetry. So it's been great for me.
In turning to writing 18 years ago, I mean, obviously you spent many years before that home in the United States, pursuing another career, a successful career. Was there part of your Vietnam experience that you just couldn't shake or couldn't process before writing?
I still can't shake it. trauma changes personalities. And, you know, I'm certainly a different... We come back with a different personality, you know, from military experience and other traumatic events. And so you have to deal with that. And you're always going to have the trauma there just over your shoulder, and you have to continue to deal with that. I have to deal with it every day, and I have to deal with it by continuing to write. So besides these two books, I also have in draft, yet to be published, 4 novels, another book, and another book of short stories. I'm about to start on a 5th novel. Whether they get published or not, you know, that may be the justification for writing, but the therapy is there regardless of whether the material ever gets published.
How do you feel it helps you?
It lets you create your own worlds. Worlds which do not have the problems that you're dealing with, or worlds in which you can deal with the problems more easily. That has been the big thing for me, is that it takes me out of, you know, the trauma and puts me in a world that's different and where I'm perhaps more capable of dealing with it.
Your very first poem in your collection, Near Death, Near Life, has all of these juxtapositions of regular everyday experiences that so many of us experience and what they might remind you of from your military service. Do you have that at hand? Could you read that for us?
Yes, I do. And I wrote this specifically to show people that anything can set you off. It could be scent. It could be a smell that sets you off. Smells are very powerful. It could be a sight. It could be anything that all of a sudden you're back into something that you experienced. And the name of the poem is called Sweat Dreams. Near my hunting boots, a broke-back rabbit jerks. Blood smell, knife pricks my nostrils. soldiers' bodies twitch in the grass. A fire-black, glass-shattered chivy squats in a ditch. Shadows chase the wrecker's throbbing light. A rocket-propelled grenade's magma-hot sun, overturned, smoked Jeep, faces burned off. The syrup stink of a packing plant's slaughtered hogs flushes through the car vents. My Vibram sole jungle boots deadlift mud, repetition after repetition, slog between day-old bullet-flowered corpses. In the corral's dry gray dust, a dead cow, ballooned with August heat, waits the knacker's truck. Dead soldiers' swollen innards burst. Flies deposit human grease on my hands and face.
Sweat dreams from near death, near life. Do you find yourself having those experiences every day, or is this something that comes a little less frequently?
it was a lot more frequent with the first 5 or 6 years that I was back. Now it's not so frequent, but those things still come when some sensory input stimulates, you know, that's connected to the particular memory. And this is apparently something that almost all soldiers have, that something will stimulate them and the memory comes back regardless of where you're at.
I'm talking with Dennis Malsby. His poetry collection is Near Death, Near Life. He also has a collection of short stories called Free Fire Zone. He is a Vietnam War veteran who lives in Ames. And Truman is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Truman. Truman, are you there?
Yes. Good morning. I want to just thank Dennis for his service. And I was in Vietnam in the 60s with Air Force Intelligence, and I would fly, have a crew that fly me over Vietnam, radio communication down to CIA, I guess I shouldn't say that, but basically I found just the trauma of war and artwork and to alleviate the stress, and I totally agree with Dennis how just smells or something, memories would just surface, and I really want to read his poetry, and thank you, Charity, for bringing this to us.
Well, I'm glad I could. Truman, thank you so much for calling. And Dennis, I'm sure you hear from a lot of other veterans who tell you the same thing Truman just did.
Yes, indeed. And it doesn't seem to matter what war. There's always been these problems. And we talked today about PTSD. Well, they've had words for it for every war. Based on my research, the one I thought was most effective was actually the Civil War, that people came back from that, of course, very bloody Civil War, and they called PTSD, then they called it soldier's heart. And I thought that's about as close as you can get to it.
The poetry also communicates to someone like me, someone who doesn't have military service. It's gut-wrenching and it's heartbreaking, and it's a visceral experience to read the poems, and I'm sure it's nothing even close to actually having the experience yourself. But that's an important part of this process for you as well, to communicate to people who just don't understand what it was like.
We need to understand in order to avoid making mistakes. It's like Santayana's famous expression that those who don't learn the lessons of history will make the same mistakes.
Let's talk a little bit about your short stories, and maybe, again, you could start off by reading us a little bit from Free Fire Zone.
Okay. just to define a free fire zone initially, basically what that was is that in Vietnam there were areas, especially where logistics and resupply for the Viet Cong came through, where we moved in and took out all the villagers. And basically, you know, it was an area that if anybody was in it, they were going to be an enemy. And if you were flying over or patrolling through that free fire zone, and you were found anybody there, you were at liberty to shoot them and asking no questions. So a free fire zone. And this is from the first story. The black came, blacker than black, not just the absence of light, a blackness of sound, a blackness of mind and soul. It crept in, as it always did, after the rocket attacks in the morning hours that one wanted to believe were inviolate. It grew so thick the pulse of his organs could be felt against the skin. The blackness filled every surface and irregularity. The slow tide would crest the earth berm, leak through the sandbagged bunkers to touch booted feet, and then rise to groins and chests. It filled the barrels of rifles, pressed cloth against flesh, pushed out the air as it entered pores, noses, and ears, until its acid velvet was all there was. I prayed that while it had our bodies and minds, it would not take our souls. If by some chance God let us return, I knew it would still be inside us, making us as lepers to wives and lovers, parents, friends, and worst of all, to each other. Pain in my knuckles brought me back a little. I pulled my fist back from the sandbagged wall. We'd go out soon. I listened to the breathing of the others. The acrid odor of confined male fear burned my nostrils. I assured myself we were safe. The sides of the bunker were built into a 10-foot-high earth berm. The exposed front face consisted of four thicknesses of alternating sandbags pounded with mallets into rock-hard walls. Overhead, rough-cut wood beams topped with perforated steel runway panels supported layers of sandbags. Similar bunkers looked out every 50 meters, their weapons ports aligned for interlocking fire. Even so, the threat of ground attack was not the danger tonight. Charlie's artillery rockets had delay fuses. They dug in deep, creating the runways at the airstrip. They would also burst through bunker roofs before exploding. I didn't want to be one of those, my blood leaking into the grasping dirt, suffocating while I listened to the muffled shouts of the men above trying to dig me out. The attacks came three or four times a week, always in the early hours. The enemy didn't want you rested. After months of sleep deprivation and adrenaline highs, soldiers became emotionally bruised and unfocused, susceptible to delusions and neurotic behavior. I should know.
Dennis Malsby reading from Free Fire Zone. And Dennis, we're nearly out of time, but one of the things that really struck me about the stories in Free Fire Zone is that there's, in so much literature about war, in popular culture about war, there's the good guys and the bad guys, and there's a moral code to what you're seeing. Your stories, it's very ambiguous. We don't know who's good, who's bad. Was that important to you to convey those shades of gray?
I would just say, welcome to reality.
How do you think writing these stories and this poetry, with just a minute left, how has that changed you?
Well, I think it's brought me back to a level keel and given me some balance. Again, it's not, it hasn't chased it away. I mean, I can't forget the stuff. And so it's an ongoing process of constant therapy, of writing and dealing with, what my experience has been. And again, I would certainly recommend it to anyone, veterans, or anyone experienced trauma, you know, try creativity and writing, give it a try.
And you said that throughout this experience, it has freed you to write more about other things. How much of your work tends to be about other things these days?
Well, the four novels and the short stories that I've written really have no connection to Vietnam. So again, it's been a really great therapy, and I take it as a symbol of its success that I can write about other things.
Well, Dennis, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Charity.
Dennis Malsby of Ames. He is the author of a poetry collection called Near Death, Near Life, and a collection of short stories called Free Fire Zone. He is a Vietnam War veteran and also a retired bank president who lives in Ames, Iowa. Coming up in just a moment, we'll continue talking about writing about military service as a way of making sense of it and of healing. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My next guest today is Randy Brown. He is also known by his blogger identity, Charlie Sherpa. He's a retired member of the Army National Guard, an award-winning poet, a journalist, and blogger. His blog is RedBullRising.com. His 2015 poetry collection is Welcome to FOB Haiku, War Poems from Inside the Wire. Hello, Randy.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Hey, thank you.
And let's talk a little bit about your background. As I mentioned, you are a retired member of the Army National Guard. When did you get involved?
Well, in college. Well, first off, I grew up in an active duty Air Force family. I claim Iowa's a home state because my father mustered out of the Air Force and moved back to all seven of the Quad Cities there in eastern Iowa. I swore I would go to college outside of the state of Iowa, and instead I chose to go to Drake University and the School of Journalism there in the late 1980s. And I needed some help paying for school, and so Uncle Sam helped pay for the last 2 years of my time there. And I expected to repay him with 4 years of active service in the Army after I graduated. And instead, I found that my girlfriend at the time got called up for Desert Storm. And instead, I went to Fort Gordon, Georgia, and learned all about Army radios and computers, and came back to the state of Iowa and joined the Iowa Army National Guard, and became a community journalist down in Osceola at the Osceola Sentinel Tribune, which was a weekly there. And every weekend and 2 weeks out of the year, one weekend every month and 2 weeks every year, I would put on the uniform, and I was a citizen soldier for 20 years, of which after I retired, I think I added it up, and I think I've got 4 or 4.5 years of active duty time during that 20-year period, with all various deployments and temporary active duty back here in the state.
For people who maybe don't know someone in the Army National Guard, I mean, tell me a little bit about the culture of being a part of the Army National Guard. I mean, it's obviously different from being working within the military all the time, but it can be a really intense experience.
Well, the great thing about the Iowa National Guard particularly is that, we like to say that we serve God, country, and community. And so a lot of my early military service was on behalf of neighbors and friends and communities here in Iowa during tornadoes and blizzards and floods. So I was very, very proud of that service. Of course, you wear two hats in the National Guard as a citizen soldier. You answer usually to the governor of the state, but during times of national need, crisis, or natural disaster, you can also be federalized and answer to the president as your commander in chief. And in 2003, during Operation Iraqi Freedom, I found myself in the unique position of being transferred. Over the space of a weekend, I was the slang term is it voluntold. I was voluntold to report to an infantry battalion in Waterloo, the 133rd Infantry, and we were sent during the war in Iraq. We were sent to a temporary mission that has been there since the 1980s in Egypt. And so I joke that I got a combat patch, but for peacekeeping duty. And then later on in my military career, toward the end of it, in 2009, we got word that It was billed at the time as the largest call-up of Iowa troops since World War II, that I and 3,000 of my colleagues were going to be picked up and flown halfway around the world to help secure the government of Afghanistan.
But you didn't end up going on that trip.
No. You know, my family and I had spent 18 months, along with everybody else, getting mentally, physically, spiritually, legally, financially ready to deploy. And 10 days before we were to change to that federal status, we were all up in Boone, and we were throwing our duffel bags on the back of the truck. And First Sergeant said, "Hey, everybody, throw your duffel bags on the back of the truck. But hey, Brown, wait a minute, we need to talk to you." So 10 days from what we call Mobilization Day, or M-Day, I found that something in my paperwork would not allow me to go. And so my wife, at the time, I think she described it as a two-year emotional roller coaster ride that ended in a brick wall.
So as a journalist and a communications expert, you were not just doing your job, but or maybe this was part of your job, you were also responsible for sort of a more informal internal communication?
At the time, there was a, and I believe there still is, the Army was experimenting with something called knowledge management. And so they had created a position called knowledge manager, or battle command knowledge manager. And I found myself suddenly assigned to that position because I was the only one in the organization who seemed to know what it was. I had done some reading on behalf of another officer and given him a briefing. And then I again was voluntold that I was going to be the guy. That position is unique in that it is half computers, half working with people on how to use their technology better, and the other half, and yes, I'm up to 150% there, the other half is taking in of lessons. A lesson in Army Talk is knowledge based on experience. A lesson learned is knowledge based on experience that is applied to change either your individual behavior or your organization's behavior. And then a lesson learned is best when it is then shared with others so that they don't make the same mistakes that you did. So the other, quote, half my job was finding lessons, taking them down, sharing them with other people in the organization as well as the U.S. Army at large.
And this is the time when your alter ego, Charlie Sherpa, came into being.
Well,
how did that happen?
The best way to share information within an organization was an internal blog, and I found myself blogging as Randy Brown inside the organization, and I was taking a lot of questions from my commanders and peers, asking me opinions on how to do this with this piece of technology or this computer application or whatnot. At the time, military blogging or mil blogging was very, very hot. Very popular, and I'm kind of a learn-by-doing kind of guy. So I decided to ask forgiveness and not permission and went out and started a military blog called Red Bull Rising, kind of a tip of the hat to the Tom Clancy novel Red Storm Rising, but with the organizational emblem of the 34th Infantry Division, the Red Bull Division. And I had sort of a nickname, Sherpa, because I was always kind of helping out in the background. I needed a first name to sign up for my blogspot.com account, so I became Charlie Sherpa.
What has that alter ego allowed you to do?
Of course, when I started out, it was to learn how to learn how to use the blogging technology at the time. I thought I was going to be amusing my friends and my peers, and I, didn't use any real names, tried to change all the names to protect the guilty. And what I found was that because Charlie Sherpa had no rank and no specified military job, he, much like my job as a knowledge manager, he could walk through walls, metaphorically. And he I found myself getting a lot of letters and messages from spouses, from friends, from sons and daughters saying, hey, thank you for telling us about how you, the obstacles and the challenges that your family is trying to address in your preparation to go to Afghanistan. Because when my spouse gets home from training, they're too tired, or they're working their own road to war. They're trying to figure out how to get ready, and so they're somewhat shutting down. It was quite enlightening. As a former community journalist, it's all about serving a community, and I found myself, or at least Charlie Sherpa found himself, writing for a community of National Guard family.
Where does the poetry come in?
Well, you hit the nail on the head there, because I often joke that I finally found a vocation that pays less than newspaper journalism, and that's military poetry. Poetry is it's not threatening. It's familiar to people. Haiku poetry and sonnets, particularly, we learn these in grade school and junior high. I was gratified that after I had written the poetry collection, that my own children began to learn haiku in grade school, and so we were able to share that kind of experience. There's a lot of poetry in military life. Everything from Charge of the Light Brigade to the marching cadences we all learn in basic training, and it also I try to make it feel somewhat subversive. In the sense that, soldiers don't manly men and womanly women don't typically, aspire to read poetry. But hey, maybe there's something funny and snarky and insightful going on here. So I try to use humor as a way to kind of get the message out.
Right, as evidenced by this headline on your blog, "Listen Up, Maggots! It's National Poetry Month." could you share one of your poems with us?
Certainly. And since you're going with the humor of it, I'll read a short selection of haiku here. One thing you need to know about one of these poems: when your M16 or your M4 rifle jams, you are trained to go through a set of procedures that is. The mnemonic is the word sports, and you'll hear the word that mnemonic in play in the third haiku here. Your squad leader writes haiku. Bound as fire teams, I'm up, he sees me, I'm down. Action front leapfrog. Push through the ambush, like hornets roused out of nests, ablaze with hatred. Your weapon is jammed? Slap, pull, observe, release, tap, then squeeze the trigger.
What do you think writing, especially haiku poetry, what does that do for you?
It's short. If you don't understand one, you very quickly go on to read the next one, so it's like eating potato chips. It is a way, again, to convince your buddies that they should read something that they are pretty convinced they're not going to like. In some applications, you can fit it into organizational newsletters and things like that. You can hang it up on bulletin boards, and nobody's going to get in trouble. But people can read it in passing and chuckle over it and move on. And of course, the best ones always have some sort of nugget of experience or insight that perhaps somebody can go back to and think about more.
We were talking earlier with Dennis Malsby, and he was encouraging everyone who's been through a traumatic experience, which military service so often is, to write. And you also encourage your fellow veterans to write as a form of therapy, as a way of working through something. And, listening to Dennis's poetry, it's a very different experience from funny haikus. So, when you encourage people to write, it sounds like anyway, just put pen to paper. Why do you think it's so important?
Well, whenever I'm participating in or instructing at a at a veterans writing workshop or a writing workshop that has both veterans and civilians in it. Because I think, you know, each of us has an experience with the military, regardless of whether we serve in uniform or not. And there's some great poetry out there by military spouses, by friends and family who again, have not served in uniform, but they do have an experience with the military. I do think that, you know, I often say that writing can be therapeutic, but it sure as heck ain't therapy. And a lot of the communities that with which I engage are engaging in writing not necessarily as a therapy or a therapeutic drive, but it's more of a literary pursuit. There are many 21st century writing people out there who are engaged in military themes and topics in not only poetry but fiction and nonfiction. So, you know, they're doing it to share their experiences, to record their experiences. I really think that we all need to kind of engage each other in dialogue. We're not necessarily about, you know, in some ways, I don't want to reinforce the all veterans are broken trope. And in talking solely about traumatic writing or writing about trauma, that's a very important piece of this. But at the same time, we're also talking about fixing maybe a broken society where, you know, there's this civilian-military gap, a canyon of misunderstanding or non-understanding between civilian society and the military that it serves it.
Well, and you even experience a gap within different military branches, and since you served in the Army National Guard, there can be quite a gap in understanding as well.
The Brown family Thanksgiving dinner table has, we have to translate between Air Force, Army, and occasionally Navy and Marine. So, yes, it's all one team, but everybody speaks their own language.
And for someone who doesn't have military experience, in reading some of your pieces and reading about what it's like to be home on a short home leave when you're deployed, I found that to be really enlightening. What do you want non-military people to take away from what you have to share?
Well, that we are, you know, we have asked an awful lot of our friends and neighbors. You know, we spend a lot of blood and treasure to do things that, you know, we're asking people to do things on our behalf. And so we need to pay attention to what they are doing and what they have done and to honor that and to understand that and to move out together.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you very much.
Randy Brown, he is also known by his blogger identity, Charlie Sherpa. He blogs at RedBullRising.com. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.